Welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Here, we speak with extraordinary games industry professionals and listen to their story to learn all about what they've built and who they are. GamesNet Berlin Europe is the international games industry initiative of MediaNet Berlin Brandenburg, the networking association for the media, creative and digital industries in Germany's capital region. My name is Simon Oehler and I will be your host for this program. Today, I'm speaking to Philipp Hübner. Phil is the Chief Business Development Officer at Challenger Mode, a Stockholm-based esports infrastructure platform. What that means, you will find out during the episode. Phil and I have worked closely alongside each other at Twitch and have been friends before that time, so I'm delighted to catch up with him on the show and offer you, the listener, a more personal touch between my guests and I. In part one, which you're listening to now, we speak about Challenger Mode, what it is, the company's purpose, and how they intend to achieve that purpose. We cover Phil's career, ranging from managing an esports team in his teens to directing more than 200 writers at an online publication at 18, onto ESL, Twitch, and finally freelance life and Challenger Mode. And during all that, we cover lessons learned, what worked and what didn't, and why esports was always at the core of Phil's career and his purpose. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast to also find part two of this episode. In part two, we go over Phil's personal life, his motivations, what shaped him, and how he transformed over recent years. Thank you for being here, and please enjoy my conversation with Philipp Hübner. Hello, and welcome to the show, Phil Hübner.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Hey.
Hey, my pleasure. Phil, you're the Chief Business Development Officer at Challenger Mode. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Nice. And before we begin, I think for context, it's nice to know that we've actually known each other for quite some time. So I was quite happy to see you on my guest list here. Mm. I believe we've met maybe close to 10 years ago, 2011, 2012, I believe at Gamescom.
Yeah.
You were a writer for ESFI, I don't even know if they exist anymore, an old esports coverage site. And before that, you were a Dota pro gamer, and then you became a person at ESL, and then we actually worked together for a while at Twitch. So we actually have quite a story together, isn't that right?
Yeah, we do. I think back when we first met, you were actually commentating WCG.
Yeah, that would have been Gamescom 2012. Yeah, there was a WCG StarCraft II tournament at Gamescom.
Yeah. That was the second time I believe we met.
I got into trouble at that tournament because I halted a game because people didn't have headphones and they could hear everything I was saying, and then I stopped the game and made it go to before we started the game, made it go to advertisement, and I wasn't allowed to do that because I wasn't the producer. But then I ran, got like Mickey Mouse ear sound protectors for the players because somehow I knew where to get them, and then I started the game. Got into real trouble, but the competitive integrity was saved.
It's a good thing to get in trouble for.
I think so too. You have pretty much dedicated your life to esports and video games. I would love to get into that and into your career, but maybe we can start at Challenger Mode. I know you guys raised 12 million at the end of last year. That's a lot due to you and your team. Can you walk us through that and tell us about Challenger Mode? What are you doing there? What is your vision? Let's just tell that story. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like you said, we recently raised $12 million. It's a part of a total of $20 million US dollars that we've received in funding over the years, including some of the money that came before I joined. And I joined the company 3 years ago as the head of business development back then. I started off sort of working some partnerships, figuring out how to grow the company through partnerships with organizers and brands and so on. And what Challenger Mode does, you know, we're an esports infrastructure platform, so that means we build technology and we build integrations and software for game developers, software for tournament organizers and influencers to automate tournaments, and then allow influencers and tournament organizers to utilize that automation to easily host tournaments for their communities. And then we build a lot of sort of products around that core concept of automating tournaments, such as monetization, so that you know, people can charge subscriptions and entry fees, and can charge tickets to enter those things, and so on. And you know, over the years, it's gone from us just working with a few national leagues and a couple of high school leagues to us having deals with now FIFA, where you know, they host all of their national qualifiers through us. We have deals with DreamHack. We've worked extensively with many big publishers like Riot Games and EA on some of their projects, some of their official projects too. And we have a pretty large and growing footprint also in the collegiate space in general, in the scholastic space, where we in the US help a lot of high school and university leagues do what they do.
And you're in Sweden, right? Challenger Mode is a Swedish company, so you already have global reach with your platform.
Yeah, exactly. So when I joined the company 3 years ago, we were actually only open to the Nordic market, so just Northern Europe. Just after I joined, basically, we started expanding into the rest of Europe. And then last year was the first time that we really started working with the global market and hosting tournaments at a global scale. And one of those, you know, one of those things is we're now kind of expanding into North and South America, growing a team there and establishing more partnerships there.
Why is it important for the esports market? Let me ask this way: how are you important for the esports market and landscape?
So I would say there's two elements to that question, or to that answer. One of them is, hosting a tournament is a lot of work, especially if you're hosting a tournament for hundreds and hundreds of players, or even thousands of players. Right? You need literally dozens or hundreds of administrators if you're hosting a very large scale tournament. And so, for instance, you know, ESL, who are obviously the biggest esports league, at least in the Western world, or company, they have over 1,500 administrators, including all their volunteers that host all of their competitions. So that's obviously way too much for most people to actually be able to scale up and start hosting something. So the automation we provide allows people, basically on their own, to host tournaments for hundreds of people without needing to hire any administrators, right? So we're allowing people to scale more easily, and we're giving power to local leagues, to, you know, city leagues, and so on, that might not have the budget and the means to host something big.
It's kind of like what Twitch is to broadcasting. You do for competition and the structure around that. So what Twitch made possible was broadcasting without a studio or much equipment at all, or trained personnel. And it seems like that's what you just described as what you do for tournaments, competition in esports, but seemingly of any kind, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good analogy. So, you know, Twitch obviously lets people to broadcast from their bedrooms. I mean, there's a crazy story about the I don't remember his name, but that Spanish streamer who recently got over 2 million concurrent viewers, right?
The Gref G.
Exactly. From his bedroom, essentially, right? And
right, that's up, yeah.
That's what we want to do for tournaments, right? We want to allow somebody to host a world championship, essentially, in any game from their bedroom.
And so you described that. Just to repeat kind of my understanding, and you can correct me if something's wrong. So you You can go to challenger mode. You can kind of, anybody can, you know, set up a bracket, which is like the core functionality of a tournament, which if you were talking about ESL, no front, but like the ESL tournament brackets, when I used to cast StarCraft 2 or something, it was always a terrible overview. It was not a very good technology to look at that. So it seems like that's important to just have a good visual product. And then you also enable people, like you said, especially influencers who are maybe in the esports space, want to host their own competition, to both set it up, which you just described, but then also to monetize it, right? So you can have entry fees, subscriptions. So you're, and that's kind of the core of your business.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Yeah. And that's the, you know, and that's the second part, right? I said there's two parts to what we do for the industry and why it's important. And the second part is exactly this. It's the monetization element, right? You know, there's so many people that are esports fans, and so few of them actually spent money on esports, right? A lot of them spent money on games. Obviously, you know, they buy skins, they buy loot boxes, and they buy games, right? Straight up. But a lot of them don't spend any money for participating, for watching, for anything of that kind. And a lot of people in esports obviously see that as a big issue, right? I just saw a thread on Twitter just a day or two ago again, where people were complaining about the fact that esports is, you know, free to watch, and that there's no way we're ever going to be able to switch to a pay-per-view model, but that pay-per-view model would already fix a lot of the monetary issues that the esports industry has. So long story short, you know, we want to make it easier for organizers to really monetize their audience.
Yeah, and I think we spoke about this briefly before, but just to visualize it, if you compare it to, let's say, traditional sports where, you know, well, how do you compare it exactly? Because, I mean, I guess people, like, let's say football fans, soccer fans, whatever, they buy like jerseys, scarves, I don't know, like tickets, right, to a stadium, like, depending on how hardcore a fan they are. What possibilities do people have right now to spend on esports? Or in your description, what gets counted on this revenue spend?
Yeah, so I mean, today, I guess looking at it not from the esports fans' perspective, but rather the organizer's perspective, an organizer makes money from media rights, from sponsorships, from selling merchandise, selling tickets to their events, and you know, potentially advertising, but that's you know, that I guess falls within the bucket of sponsorships. So that's basically it, right? There's nothing outside of that, and most of the time, there's so much money spent on big events and on hosting events that you know, the tickets hardly even allow them to break even on the event spent, right? So there just isn't that much going on there. And then for smaller organizers, like if you're looking at a Swedish national league or a Finnish national league, because esports is still very much in its baby shoes, to be honest, most of these organizers don't have access to selling their media rights, right? They're not big or relevant enough, I guess, quote unquote, to be selling their media rights to anyone. So that's already a revenue stream that's out of the window. So to go to the players or the viewers point of view, then the only things that they can spend money on is obviously the game itself. And then they can buy jerseys, they can buy merchandise, and they can buy a ticket to go to an event. But that's pretty much it.
Right. And then challenger mode comes in, and could you paint that picture? Because I think then we kind of got it.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, we would come in there, and we give you the ability to host hourly tournaments if you wanted to, right? You could be hosting a tournament that runs once every hour, that gives you prize money, that allows you to win access to something, that allows you to win points over time, whatever it is you want to do. And then we give you control over that, and we let you charge a subscription, which you're free to set the price of that subscription as well. Or you can sell a season pass, right? Where you can say, okay, I'm going to sell a ticket once every 6 months, and that's the whole season. And if you buy this pass, you're going to be getting access to all the tournaments we run.
So that could be, as an example, like a national / collegiate league, I think something you mentioned. I'm also imagining, let's say, a streamer. I've been watching a lot of Apex Legends streams because I've been trying to get better at that. And they're obviously constantly in competition. And much like many streamers have like Discord servers running where their people can meet and stuff, it seems like it would be valuable to have a tournament or a series of tournaments running just like as a beat kind of channel to your stream where your guys can subscribe and then just, let's say while you stream or something, they can all the time play intra-community against each other. Is that a good example, or do you have a better one?
Yeah, I think that's a good example. And, you know, another good one, obviously both of us having a past at Twitch. Another good one is sort of this notion of, you know, if you're a Counter-Strike streamer, right, you play nothing but Counter-Strike on stream. So you play Counter-Strike for eight hours a day, every single day. You know, maybe you have a day off once a week.
Right. Maybe you play more once a week.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what their schedule realistically looks like, right? So obviously these guys get bored of their games sometimes, and they need to find new ways to make things engaging. And I truly believe that running tournaments for and with their community, right, playing with their community, is a good way to mix things up and make things a little more exciting again.
Got you. What would you say, to round up the thing about Challenger mode, what would you say is your vision? What do you want to be? What's your moonshot? What are you aiming at?
So we want to be, simply put, we want to be the home of esports, right? We want to be the infrastructure, the railroad that takes you through the world that is esports. So when it comes to game developers, you know, we want to enable them to tap into all the hundreds and thousands of organizers that use Challenger Mode. For the organizers, we want to enable them to utilize these automations and tap into our good relationships with these game publishers and developers to be able to easily host competitions and perhaps even get support from the game developers directly.
Nice. And you've also told me you want to be the tech platform of esports. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that esports traditionally has done is that every esports company goes out and does everything, right? Like the reason that ESL has a tech platform, the reason that ESL has a store, the reason that ESL has all of these things is that they kind of had to, right? There was no one to help them do any of these things. And to explore how do we make money in esports, they just had to build everything themselves. But obviously, ESL is actually best at hosting events, right? They're absolutely kick-ass at hosting big stadium events, doing AAA broadcasting, and so on. And so we have this belief that, you know, we don't want anybody to have to do everything themselves. And we believe that a company that is fully focused on tech can build much better tech than any company that isn't, right?
Got you. Makes perfect sense. Thank you. Let's talk about your career. Like I mentioned in the beginning, as far as I know your bio, and I know you a little bit, you started out as a Dota pro player, as a writer in esports, and then as kind of a product manager at ESL, and as we can see today, you're still deeply involved, probably more than ever, in the, let's say, the possible core of the esports industry. When did you dedicate your life to esports and games?
So this is actually funny because I can pinpoint the exact moment that happened.
I had hoped so. Yes.
So obviously I've played games all my life, right? I was 2 years old when I played my first video game, which was Worms, actually, on my uncle's computer. And then I quickly, you know, picked up Quake and Unreal and a few games that I probably shouldn't have played at my young age. But, you know, I had access to those games because my family was very, very techie. And, you know, life went along and I got access to the internet and all that stuff. And then I had this friend at high school. And he didn't have internet at first because German internet infrastructure back then was pretty rough. So he actually gave me his copy of Half-Life 2. Activate on Steam. So I did that because I had internet and he didn't. And I started playing Counter-Strike Source. And then over time, he himself got internet and we started playing a lot of Warcraft 3 together online. And he dared me, I think, to try and win a tournament in Dota or something along those lines. I remember that distinctly because as a result of that conversation, I ended up reaching out to some MOW Sports players and started getting into the scene on IRC. You know, I was like 11 years old. So that is actually exactly how this started. And then I joined them as a manager and started playing as a stand-in with them, but also had a team that I played with over the summer holidays and things like that. We were practicing scrimming 12 hours a day, right?
Were you still 11 when you became a manager?
I was 12 or 13, I think, when I was managing the team.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. That's so good. How old were the other players?
Maybe 17, 18, I think.
That's so funny. Did that work? Like, what did you manage? Could they listen to you?
So they didn't know how old I was, obviously. you know, it was still very early on. So I never told anybody how old I was on the internet. And I was managing their schedules, you know, I was managing their scrims. As I said, I once in a while played with them and just doing general sort of team manager tasks.
Understood. Okay. So interesting. Was it all via IRC? So no voice, no Skype or anything? So
At that age, I still sounded a little young, obviously. So I avoided jumping on Ventrilo whenever I could.
Okay, I got you. That's hilarious to me, but that just goes to show that that's a brand new thing that was going on, right? So that's the exact moment. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the moment. So as a result of that, you know, I played a lot of CS. I played a lot of Dota. I got super active on IRC and chatted with a lot of pro players across other games too. And I started learning more about the esports industry. You know, there were the first $1 million tournaments in Call of Duty back then. There was a, I think this was Call of Duty 4 actually. And, you know, CS was the biggest thing, I think, at the time in terms of salaries in Europe, right? I think CSGO maybe had the only salary teams in esports at the time. So then I, you know, as I learned all these things, we qualified for ESWC in 2005, MOW Sports, that is.
So I guess CSGO wasn't around at the time, but it was CS Source.
Yes, CS Source, yeah. And CS 1.6 was actually the game that had the salary teams.
Okay, you just said CSGO, to make sure.
My bad.
And then you qualified for ESWC.
In Dota,
exactly, just to get these things straight.
So,
please continue.
So we qualified for ESWC in Dota, and we weren't allowed to... Oh, apologies, let me mute that. We weren't allowed to go because the team, you know, the MOW Sports, they just... It wouldn't have made any monetary sense to send us. Sending us would have been more expensive than what they could have gotten out of it, even if we had taken first place and they had taken all of the money.
Right.
So they just refused to send us, even though we qualified. And to me, that was the notion where I was like, okay, this, you know, this doesn't make any sense. There's no way I can make a career out of this. So that's when I actually turned to journalism. So for a year or two, I got kind of demotivated. I then started playing Heroes of New Earth competitively. That was the same time event.
Dota, kind of the first standalone Dota game, like mobile game, you could probably say, right? Like that
exactly. Got
competitive popularity, just for the listener, in case they don't know.
So it was bigger than League of Legends at that time. And League of Legends propped up at the same time. And, you know, I played a while. And then, like you said in the beginning, I discovered this website called ESFI World, which I thought was really, really cool. You know, I thought they were way ahead of everybody else when it came to just their layout and the quality of work they put out in journalism and esports. And I wrote to them and I told them, hey, do you guys know about MOBAs? Because they didn't write about Dota or Han or any of that stuff at all. So I wrote to them and asked, hey, do you guys know about MOBAs? You guys should start writing about it. And they were like, yeah, why don't you come on board and why don't you write about this? So I did, and I built up a team of, I think it was something stupid, like 200 volunteers across the three game sections that wrote about League of Legends, about Dota 2, when it then started coming out, and about Han.
You built a team of 200 people. And again, how old were you then? I think it's always interesting what that was around.
So when? I started this when I was around 16, 16, 17, 18. That's also when I first started traveling to esports events for them to, you know, go out there and do interviews with players and so on.
Hmm. Yeah, that's crazy, right? That's a huge kind of responsibility you've built at the time at again a fairly young age.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, obviously, I had a lot of help doing so. You know, I found a lot of people that were able to help me out. One of them is Philip Aram. He's now the COO at Evil Geniuses, which is a major esports team. And a couple other people that are still in esports to this day. So there were a lot of passionate people at ESFI that made it all happen. A lot of whom are definitely still around and still doing things.
Yeah. So let's move it along to ESL, your times at ESL and at Twitch. If I, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that your times at ESL and Twitch weren't really, let's say, super high times in terms of your career progress. Just is that roundabout correct, or how would you see that?
I would say, you know, when I dropped out of school and I joined ESL, that was when I was 18. At first it really wasn't what I imagined, right? Because I was an intern, so I was laying cables and doing things like that. So the first year or so was a lot of career progress for me personally, right? Being promoted to being a product manager. Hmm. But after that, I would say I stagnated pretty quickly. Yeah, it was definitely a pretty micromanagey environment, especially because, you know, it's all project management in that company, or it was at the time.
Hmm. And how long did you stay at ESL, and how was it? What did you end up doing then?
Yeah, so I was at ESL for 3.5 years, and in those 3.5 years, I went from being an intern to being a product manager to where I was part of the Intel Extreme Masters, which was, you know, at the time I would say the biggest tournament series in the world. And we were the ones that put esports into a stadium for the first time too. So I was lucky enough to be a part of that. And you know, my job was essentially all of their communication, right? I was in charge of all PR, of the web presence, of all of their social media channels for ESL and IEM. Then I started also their and helped build up their editorial team when they went and started building an editorial team, which obviously came naturally to me after having done what I did at ESFI.
Right. And then there was a time where you transitioned to Twitch. How did that happen?
Yeah. So after a while, I felt like I was ready to move on from ESL, and I started looking around. I applied for a bunch of companies. Transparently, I did interviews with, you know, with Riot Games. I flew to Dublin. I did a bunch of interviews with other game companies in Amsterdam. In the end, I moved to Scotland with my to live with my girlfriend at the time. And during that time there, I was applying for a bunch of remote positions, and one of them was promotions manager at Twitch. And you know, then I was hired for that job, and kind of it was very close to what I did before, because it was essentially very focused on Twitch and Twitch esports, right? It was focused on all of the esports activities that were going on Twitch, and the promotion of those, making sure that people are watching them, that people are aware of them.
Right. Sorry, I wasn't ready for that pause at all. I thought the story would continue.
I mean, I can continue the story there. I think half a year or so, I think it took about 4 to 6 months. We moved my position from being part-time to being full-time. I moved to London, where I worked alongside you as well, where I was in charge of content marketing for basically the European region. Mm. And then, you know, at first there, I had a huge growth spurt career-wise, I would say, where, you know, I got the opportunity to pitch for a new job towards the VP of marketing at the time. Was put in charge of sort of international marketing. So I started working not just with a European team, but also with a Latin American team, and, you know, the Japanese team, and Taiwan and Korea and so on, and helped them with the coordination of all their product marketing and content marketing and all of that stuff. So that was very exciting. But then after a while within that role, I would say I've found myself into a similar position of sort of stagnation again, where I stopped learning.
And what would you say were you motivated towards? What were you in all your kind of, because there's a pattern that I would describe of like, well, you go somewhere and you actually take significant responsibility for another pro team that you're like part of at 13, 14, for a whole new section on a site and team that belongs to that at 17, 18. And then, you know, the start, and that's why I kind of prefaced it with like, you know, maybe ESL and Twitch wasn't so much for you. It seemed like there you just didn't get the responsibility that you needed to thrive. Would you say that's right?
I would say yes to some extent. I think I was given some responsibility. So I think they were very important steps in my career growth, right? Because I was given more and more responsibility over the years. But obviously, as soon as I was, you know, things were stopping, as soon as I was not given more responsibility anymore within these companies, right. That's when I would say, yeah, I lost my interest.
Right. And so you ended up leaving Twitch. You went on a freelance journey, I would say, and ended up at Challenger Mode, what we talked about today already. What are you doing now? And I mean, feel free to tell the story how you got there. And then also, I'm very curious, what are you doing now that's different, that enables you to, you know, have a significant impact, you know, leading a team, raising multiple million dollars? What's different now?
So I think one of the things that I've always lacked is formal education, and one of the things I've always had was an ability to connect the dots, right? If that makes sense. I think I've always been pretty good at seeing opportunities, seeing windows of opportunity and collaboration. And so it was kind of obvious for me to take a step into business development. You know, it's definitely taking that step after leaving Twitch. And as a freelancer, I also did business development. That was definitely something that allowed me to thrive personally. Directly, but then beyond that, I would say it's been a very big focus on not just trying to succeed myself, but it's always been a focus on how do I make others succeed? How do I create opportunities for people around me?
And can you be concrete on that? Because I'm very curious about that from a behavioral standpoint. How do you create opportunities for others at the moment? What exactly do you do to make that happen? Maybe a few examples, maybe some general habits.
Yeah. So if I get to name drop here, Kevin Lin is somebody who said this to me, where he is convinced that, you know, network is something that should be free, right? And I think that Kevin, over all my conversations with him over the years, has definitely impacted me. And that is, you know, that is the essence of what I do, right? I try to find what is it that people are looking for, and then I simply connect them with other people from my network that that will have use for them, bluntly put, right? So, you know, one example of such a thing is one of the organizers on Challenger Mode recently has come to me and they got a big deal, a big licensing agreement with one of the publishers that they work with. I'm not going to name any names.
Sure.
And they're like, hey, we need some, you know, we need some assistance. Do you guys want to sponsor this? Or, you know, we need some money. So I went and I connected them to the relevant people at Twitch. I went and connected them to the relevant people within certain companies that I knew would be interested in something like what they're doing. And I think I have fostered an environment with Challenge Emote where doing this type of thing and helping this person succeed with their project helps my company succeed because I'm making an organizer successful. And that means the success of and growth of others tends to be my own personal success and growth too. I don't know if that makes sense.
That does make sense. Makes a lot of sense, actually. And I think it's very beautiful if you have the opportunity to do that because sometimes, you know, there's a lot of red tape around your ability to interact with customers. I certainly remember some of that in my career days. And it's kind of weird, but it kind of taught me the opposite, which I don't think is that great. That, you know, and I think it's one of those rules that would have been maybe worth breaking. But yeah, I think it's awesome if you can just freely connect people and just add value, you know, beyond your, let's say, beyond your paycheck, beyond your written responsibilities. I think that's very righteous. I wanted to ask you, or did you want to add something to that?
I guess one final thought on, you know, the other things I do is I guess that I've started doing some writing. I've written some articles that I hope help some people understand certain topics that I'm actively engaged with, but I've also started doing a lot of podcasts like this, doing a lot of panels, and I've recently taught an esports master's course at a university in Barcelona as well. So there's a lot of things that I'm trying to do where I'm just trying to convey knowledge, and I hope that, you know, if I can help, you know, one or two people succeed in their lives and they feel like they couldn't have done that without me, then that's a great success.
True that. I have two questions to round up part one. Here at GamesNet, the game center is very event focused. Of course, at this time, it's a little bit difficult, but I wanted to ask you, as an event guy as well, what's your favorite event that you've been going to, let's say from a business perspective, maybe also from a hangout perspective, could be different ones, and what memories do you connect with that event or these events?
So I think there's sort of three things there. From a business perspective, actually the esports bar events might be my favorite ones, just because they're very, they do this thing where they do one-on-one meetings pre-scheduled for people. So you actually get to meet a lot of people that you otherwise maybe wouldn't meet. And I really like that format.
So that's the esports bar, I think primarily in Cannes, right? And is there another one?
They're in Cannes and in Miami.
Right.
It's obviously also very nice locations to be staying at, and so it's also just enjoyable from that perspective. Then from a just hanging out and having fun, I think the TwitchCon events have actually always been very close to my heart. And I actually haven't missed a single one of them. There's a lot of people that I know and that work in this industry, even in esports directly, that attend these, and I think that's always a very unique experience. And generally, I always enjoy events that based on specific cities that they're in, right? Because there are just some great cities that I've really enjoyed traveling to for event purposes, and I think my favorite ones, at least here in Europe, are probably London and Berlin. Likely just for the fact that I still feel somewhat at home in London sometimes, you know. But yeah,
I got you. And speaking of Berlin, what's your favorite memory that you connect to Berlin?
You know what? That might actually be a previous TwitchCon event.
So TwitchCon Berlin, what do you memorize from there? What do you remember from there?
It was just, I think I was hanging out with a really nice group of people. Sort of after the event, it was very enjoyable from that perspective, and I think there were a lot of nice places to go for the frame of that event as well. So yeah.
Awesome. There will be a part two coming up where we talk about more about life in general and your development and all that. For now, for the people listening to part one, you mentioned you're writing articles, you're doing podcasts. Where can people find you?
The easiest way to find me is definitely on Twitter. That would just be Phil Hubner on Twitter.
And that's, let me see, Phil. Hubner.
Exactly. And my Medium account is also directly connected to that, so it makes it easy to find all the articles I've written on Medium as well.
Very nice. And your podcast, right? Can we find that?
So we release a podcast as Challenger Mode, actually. It's called Esports Odyssey, in which we interview pro players and other esports professionals and talk about how they got where they are and what tips they have for other people trying to achieve the same. And you can find that on Spotify, on iTunes, basically anywhere.
Amazing. So that's Esports Odyssey. Yep. Thank you, Phil. I see you in part two.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to part one of this episode. Be sure to also check out part two, which will be released 2 weeks after part one on all podcast platforms. So it might already be out by the time you hear this. Whatever platform you're on, subscribe or follow the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast to listen to many more insightful conversations with fantastic games industry guests from Berlin and from all over Europe. Thank you very much and see you very soon. Bye-bye.
Hi there. Before you go, this is Florian, project manager for GamesNet Berlin Europe. If you want to stay connected to the network, find out more about upcoming events and links to other MediaNet initiatives, you can visit us at gamesnetberlin.eu and subscribe to our newsletter. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, and until next time.